This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
There are a lot of challenges facing journalists in their line of duty. They're intimidated, harassed, threatened, and some even killed. And not a lot is being done by states to address the issue of journalist safety.
That's where the UN Human Rights Council comes in, calling all states to be more vigilant in addressing the plight of journalists. But will it work?
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, the show that puts journalism and the media in the spotlight. This week, we take a look at the UN Human Rights Council's latest resolution to protect journalists and what it means.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. Critics question the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Nepal, and zines are flourishing in Indonesia.
Almost a decade after a peacetime accord was signed between the Nepalese government and the Maoist rebel forces, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has opened up a wartime complaints registration process. In 3 months, over 55,000 complaints have been filed to the commission, including complaints against big political figures and top security officials. Rajan Parajuli met some of the victims in Kathmandu to find out more.
Deepak Kamal's father was abducted by Maoist rebels one evening in 2004, when he was at home having dinner with his wife. The next day, his body was found along a walking trail in their village. Deepak, now 36, was studying his master's degree in the capital Kathmandu at the time.
When I reached my home, the whole village had gathered there. But everyone was afraid to touch the body because there was a few grenades near the body. The militants had also left a letter with the words, "Why we had to kill Mr. Padam Hamal."
Deepak's father, Padam, was a retired teacher. He was also the ward president of the Nepali Congress Party, which was leading the government at the time. In the handwritten note next to his body, the militants blamed Padam for supporting the police to arrest Maoist rebels. Back then, there was no way to register complaints against the rebels or state security forces. It's why Deepak travelled 12 hours to Kathmandu to report the incident to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission more than a decade later.
I went to the head of police and the head of the district immediately after we found the dead body, but no one agreed to file the case. We kept fighting for 10 years. Now at least we have a place that will hear our pain. I have filed a complaint against Maoist President Prachanda and his team. As the leader of the party, he is responsible if it was an institutional decision to kill my father.
Prachanda, also known as Pushpa Kamal Dahal, was the commander of the rebel Maoist group that fought a decade-long civil war from 1996 to 2006. Today, he is better known as the Prime Minister of Nepal. During the years of conflict in Nepal, 17,000 people were killed and thousands displaced. More than 1,000 people were also forcibly disappeared. I'm here at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission at Babar Mahal in Kathmandu. It is just meters away from the Prime Minister's office. The three-month window the Commission opened for the cases of conflict to be reported closed on July 16. Commissioner Madhavi Vatta explains the types of complaints that have flooded in.
We have received a range of cases from extrajudicial killings, property being seized, displacement and torture. There are also complaints of rape, forced engagement of children as soldiers and many more.
The commission has until February 2017 to conduct a complete investigation and recommend appropriate punishment for those involved, as well as identify opportunities for reconciliation. But Madhavi says the deadline is at best unrealistic.
It's impossible to complete the task in the given date. We may not finish the complete reading of these cases in the given time. I think we need to discuss with the experts to have an understanding about the time and the process it requires to complete the investigation.
Nepal's Truth and Reconciliation Commission had been marred by controversy from day one. Lawyer Govinda Bandi says justice through the commission is highly unlikely.
What I found is they don't really believe that they would get justice. There are a couple of factors. All the appointments in the commission were politically motivated. Because of that, the independent people kind of boycotted the process. That raises a kind of credibility question. The main reason for filing this complaint in the commissions, because they did not have any alternative. People were afraid if they did not file these cases in the commission, that could result in denial of any reparation or compensation to them. The question of justice is still in question.
The confusion has also increased this month with the Maoist-led coalition now in government. The leadership of the parties in power are among those accused of committing severe human rights violations. According to Madhavi Bhatta, there is still debate within the commission regarding heinous crimes and the application of amnesty. When she says act here, she is referring to the Truth and Reconciliation Act.
The Act mentions that it doesn't allow amnesty for heinous cases such as rape, but it doesn't clearly define whether mass homicide, individual killings, and severe torture also fall into the category of a heinous crime. The provision for case postponement also does not favor the victim.
The Maoist rebels during the war, but now in government, have been publicly demanding that amnesty be granted in cases of murder, the seizure of property, and many more cases. Back to Deepak Hamal, he says amnesty for crimes such as the murder of his father are unacceptable. If they don't get justice, he says he will knock on the door of international courts to find it. For Asia Calling, this is Rajan Parajuli in Kathmandu.
As the name suggests, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up with a noble intention in mind, finding out the truth and seeking a form of justice, or to reconcile with the victims of the civil war. Yet, setting up a commission like this doesn't immediately solve any problem, especially if the execution is not right. Based on the stories we've heard, there is a possibility of amnesty being granted to those who have committed serious violations of human rights. I don't think that's how justice should be upheld.
Exactly, Hanif. But the question here is, does the commission have any bite to it, considering the Prime Minister commanded the Maoist militia? The UN has come out to say the act is fundamentally flawed and could leave the victims of conflict-related violence without access to justice, as it does not conform to Nepal's international legal obligations. An argument could be made that at least something is being done, but is it really?
Humble scissors, paper, and glue. They hardly seem like radical materials, right? But as our reporter discovered, there's a vibrant zine scene in Java, where all sorts of interesting and diverse ideas are making their way into the world with just a few humble materials. From the Indonesian city of Bandung, Nicole Kirby has more.
Just hours from Jakarta, Bandung is a creative capital of Java. On a quiet street, and through a rabbit warren of corridors, the walls lined with peeling paint, I eventually make my way into a big room in a warehouse filled with punks, artists, and music. Like musician and zine maker, Kartika Yaya.
My name is Kartika, and right now we're in Bandung for Bandung Zine Fest. It is an annual event hosted by a community in Bandung for people who make zines and love zines and want to know more about zines. So we have zine makers from all over Indonesia coming here today.
This is Bandung's third zine fest since 2012.
Well, it's I'm quite surprised there's so many people here, you know. There's so many people are very into visual things. They put their passion in this, in the scenes. You know, I don't know if it will be this crowded, but wow, it's surprising.
That's Rian, a photographer and zine maker from Depok, a city in West Java. I asked him to explain what a zine is.
Zine is like a type of publication, it's printed publication. It may be not that serious, but some of them are very serious. It's like some of them deals with life. We visualize, and yeah, sometimes we use text, sometimes we use photographs or pictures or drawings. Yeah.
Tables are lined with homemade, photocopied curiosities. Makers and lovers of this DIY craft have come to swap, sell and gift their creations for one day only. Zine maker and distributor from South Jakarta, Ika Ventiani, explained how she makes zines.
I think most of my zines are handmade. Like, I made them with my own hand, like paper, glue and scissor. And that's all materials and tools that I use.
Because they are cheap to make, usually just requiring the cost of photocopying, and because they are self-published, zines provide the opportunity to write and draw about just about anything. Ika told me how she first discovered zine 16 years ago and never looked back.
One night, at the back of my friend's car, he just got back from Bandung, and in his car there's this zine. And I saw that and I said to myself, oh, this is interesting. I would never think that I can do this or I allowed to do this, like publishing my own writings, share about my own opinions. But that night when I first saw that zine, it literally gives me like an enlightenment of, oh, actually it is actually okay. I can actually talk about this and I can actually publish my own media and my own zine. It's okay. This is something I always want to do, so why don't I do it myself too? And so I published my first zine in 2000.
Zines are full of the things that would never be printed elsewhere. I walked away with a zine with a red cover, all about periods and women writing about their own bodies. A zine about sneezing, complete with sketches of people mid-sneeze, political writings, and very personal confessions. Some are works of art, others are rough scribbles, some combined with CDs and music.
What's your favourite zine that you've picked out today?
Oh, I can't pick a favourite. There's been some art zines that are amazing, amazingly produced. I think zines have come a long way from the day when I was introduced to zines the first time. It was all cut and paste photocopy, and now it's much more diverse. And we still have the cut and paste photocopy ones, but now people are making lots of different kinds of zines, and it's much more diverse.
That's Kartika. As one of the first women to start making zines in Indonesia, Ika Ventiani agrees that over the years, the zine scene has evolved massively since 2000. One thing is that these days, there's a lot more women involved.
I feel that before, it's only like an official media of hardcore punk kids. It feels kind of like if you're not hardcore punk, you're not allowed to make one. But actually it's not, everyone should and could make their own media, make their own zine. So I'm glad that finally I think that now I see this variety of people who actually make their own zines in whatever medium, in whatever message, in whatever creative explorations and executions they wanted to be, just super awesome. And I'm really happy about it.
And even while social media and the internet have saturated every corner of the globe, zines still have a special place, says Zine Fest organizer Deden Irwin Seherman.
People still choose zines because they are free with it. There aren't any rules for how to make zines. They're just free. No deadlines, nothing. You don't need much money. There is no censorship or anything. Zines are an alternative to mainstream media, and they can be printed or distributed to everyone.
Creating one is something we all have the capacity to do, says Ika.
I remember the first time when I finished making those, how empowered I feel. to be able to see my 10 fingers actually create something like that. I think it's very powerful feelings. So I think, yes, I think everyone should, once in their lifetime, they should experience what it feels like to make their own zines with your hands. So you know that, yes, you do have the capacity to actually become the media, to actually publish media and be something, you know, not only just receiving other media in the way they feed you every day.
For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Bandung.
Wow, I didn't know that Indonesia's zine scene is very vibrant. I've been to a few events here in Malaysia and have seen some of our own homemade zines. I can say that our youths are as creative and vocal too, especially when it comes to voicing their opinion on the plight of the marginalized, sociological and cultural observations, and the state of politics in the country, of course. Those are the usual themes zines here gravitate to.
I love stories like this, and Hanif, you're right. It gives the voiceless a platform to voice their opinions. I remember back in school, I was part of the Literary and Debating Society, and we would publish newsletters or magazines. We'd have everything in there, from poetry or haiku writings to recipes and movie reviews. Literally anything we could think of. It was a really good outlet, especially since the school curriculum at that time didn't allow us that outlet. Too much memorization and regurgitation of information. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. Next up, a report on the UN Human Rights Council's latest resolution to protect journalists.
Here's a snippet of what's in store.
I don't think this is a groundbreaking resolution per se. I mean, I think it's very important to have this recognition and call on states to release arbitrarily detained journalists. It's important to recognize the need for journalists to be able to protect their sources and so use these anonymity and encryption tools. But frankly, what we've seen are resolutions on journalist safety in 2012 and in 2014. So this is a biannual resolution. And it's an important indication that the Human Rights Council is trying to create a norm around the safety of journalists, and that they see that the ongoing killing, imprisonment, and attacks on journalists are problematic. But I think that we have to be realistic in how important a resolution is compared to actual action on the ground.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It. I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
Safety is one of the most frequently discussed issues surrounding journalists. A report published by UNESCO last year shows 114 journalists were killed worldwide. And most of the perpetrators get away scot-free, with only 10% of those cases ending up in convictions. Journalists are also subjected to harassment, threats and intimidation, among others.
Last month, the UN Human Rights Council agreed, through consensus, on a comprehensive resolution to protect journalists. This latest resolution is considered by media watchdogs as groundbreaking. Courtney Retch is an advocacy director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. She explains why.
I guess you could say that it was groundbreaking because for the first time it actually addressed the need to protect the rights of journalists to use encryption and anonymity tools, which of course are part of the essential tools that journalists need to do their jobs in the 21st century. It was also the first time that it explicitly called for states to release journalists arbitrarily detained in prison. And it also raised concerns about attacks on journalists during elections.
Apart from the three new items mentioned, the other calls made to states include condemning violence and attacks against journalists,
reforming laws that are abused to obstruct their work,
stopping gender-based attacks on women,
upholding the right of journalists to protect their confidential sources, and other provisions. Now, let's explore one of the new key items highlighted by Courtney, allowing journalists to use encryption and digital security tools that enable anonymity. How will this provision actually benefit journalism?
So I think it's an important recognition that journalists require anonymity tools in order to do their jobs. Also, I think provides an alternative narrative to some of the statements by politicians and security services about encryption being something that is enabling for terrorism. I think we have to see that encryption is essential for modern reporting and that it's part of the way that journalists help keep their sources safe. So the recognition that both of these tools and approaches are really critical to 20th century reporting, to how journalists work in the digital age, is a recognition that these are multifaceted, multidimensional types of tools, and that we have to recognize the particular role that they play in promoting and ensuring press freedom.
Corney also welcomes the call to end gender-based violence against women.
Yeah, I think it's a very important aspect to recognize that there are specific challenges and difficulties and threats faced by women journalists, as well as attacks that are gendered in nature against journalists. And so we see that sexualized attacks and gender-based attacks are often, you know, a specific type of threat that journalists face. I think it's important to recognize that sexual attacks are also something that need to be addressed and prevented. So this is an important development, and it's certainly something that CPJ has been focused on. This past year, we published our annual book, Attacks on the Press, all focused on gender and media freedom worldwide. So it's something we've really been emphasizing, and it's good to see, you know, the UN member states recognizing that they need to address gender-based violence as well.
Despite praises by some quarters to this latest resolution, Courtney does not think that it is as groundbreaking as people make it out to be.
I don't think this is a groundbreaking resolution per se. I mean, I think it's very important to have this recognition and call on states to release arbitrarily detained journalists. It's important to recognize the need for journalists to be able to protect their sources and so use these anonymity and encryption tools. But frankly, what we've seen are resolutions on journalist safety in 2012 and in 2014. So this is a biannual resolution. And it's an important indication that the Human Rights Council is trying to create a norm around the safety of journalists, and that they see that the ongoing killing, imprisonment, and attacks on journalists are problematic. But I think that we have to be realistic in how important a resolution is compared to actual action on the ground.
This brings us to the question of execution and implementation. Will the provisions in the resolution see the light of day?
Let's be clear, this is a resolution. This is a normative document. The concerns that we have at CPJ is these resolutions, which are statements that any member state can sign on to and essentially has because it was adopted by consensus. And yet we know that many members of the Human Rights Council are among some of the worst offenders of human rights and the worst violators of journalist rights in the world. So it's more about seeing what sort of movement and improvement this translates to on the ground. The goal is not to have a lot of statements about how great protecting journalists is. The goal is to have fewer journalists killed, fewer journalists imprisoned. And especially when we talk about imprisonment, we know that states are the only ones who have the right to imprison journalists. You know, when a non-state actor, say ISIS or someone, kidnaps a journalist, that's called missing or kidnapped, not imprisoned. So, you know, 199 journalists who were imprisoned last year, according to CPJ census, all of those journalists were behind bars because of actions that states took. So this is about providing, you know, a normative framework that encourages states to actually take action on the ground. You know, I think also that the recognition that this resolution shows the need that journalists have to bring their safety equipment over borders. The right to have training and security equipment is another aspect that's crucial to journalism. And so it's about states allowing that equipment to cross borders. It's about allowing journalists to get visas and to enter a country in order to do their job. So what we need to see is actual action, not just, you know, the benefits that states get by signing on to a resolution that has, you know, no teeth or anything.
Do states lack the political will to actually implement changes?
Yeah, absolutely. I think political will is a huge issue, especially when we talk about redressing impunity. So a lot of the leaders in impunity are actually democratic countries that have the institutional capacity or should have the institutional capacity to investigate the murders of journalists. But in fact, what we see is that they lack political will. So certainly these types of resolutions are aimed at shifting the political will, putting pressure on states so that there, you know, develops a political will because it becomes too politically costly not to address these issues. I don't think one resolution is going to do that.
The lack of a proper mechanism in place to monitor the implementation of the UN's calls is also a problem, as there is no follow-up to the resolution once it has been made.
There's not a mechanism per se, but there are obviously NGOs, civil society, as well as, you know, parts of the UN that do monitor this. So the Universal Periodic Review, for example, is a place where you often see that the record of what states have signed on to and what they've actually done on the ground is brought up. Also, you know, at CPJ, we are tracking all of the commitments made by states and then looking at, you know, whether that's resulted in a reduction in impunity, how many journalists remain imprisoned. But this is not being done systematically, I would say, at the UN level.
So will this latest resolution by the UN bring a sweeping structural change to the protection of journalists? Courtney is pessimistic.
No, it's a resolution. I mean, it's important that there continues to be a focus on journalist safety. It's important that this is now a critical issue on the agenda and that there are, you know, these resolutions and these statements that come out. But no, this is not in and of itself going to have an impact on the safety of journalists. In fact, 2012 is when the Human Rights Council first put out the Safety of Journalists resolution. And we've seen since 2012, historic numbers of journalists being killed and imprisoned. So no, this is not translating into having an impact on the ground, at least not yet. There needs to be a lot more effort made by states and their colleagues and allies need to use these resolutions and these normative tools to put pressure through their bilateral and multilateral relationships to actually see sustained improvement on the ground.
That was Courtney Ratch, Advocacy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. This morning's show is produced by Hanif Bahruddin and me, Cheryl Kaur. To download the podcast, head on over to bfm.my/icymi.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9,
the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.